You're listening to Underground History, a collaboration between Jefferson Public Radio and the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology, or SULA. I'm your host, Chelsea Rose, and each episode we take a deep dive into little-known aspects of history in Oregon and beyond. Growing up, did you struggle with critical decisions on how many pounds of flour or how many oxen to purchase? Did you fret about diphtheria or cholera? If you answered yes to any of these questions, you are likely part of the Oregon Trail generation, which includes young Gen Xers and elder millennials whose childhood bridged the gap between analog and digital. My guests today are going to be talking about the most famous pioneering journey between those worlds, the Oregon Trail game. I'd like to welcome Philip Bouchard, creator of the 1980s Oregon Trail game that I would have played in school, to the show, along with our producer Charlie Zimmerman, who is hopping in front of the mic for a change to discuss their research on the history of the game and its reflection of the real Oregon Trail experience. Philip and Charlie, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Thanks for inviting me.
So I wanted to start with you, Philip, to talk about the role in the game in schools like mine, where they weren't just used to pass the time, but to gain computer literacy. I was talking with Charlie about this, and I don't think they understood the nuance of this initially, because it's probably hard for Gen Z folks to imagine a time when there were no computers at home. So can you tell us a little bit about what your North Star was in designing this game? Were you actually, well, you were a pioneer in your own right, but were you motivated by introducing kids to computers and getting them to focus, or were you more interested in providing an interactive way to learn about one of America's most infamous historical events?
I would say it's the latter. I was really concentrating on trying to introduce this aspect of American history to young people in a very engaging way. And since I was actually mandated to target primarily the home audience rather than the school audience, this was particularly important that I balance the entertainment with the educational aspect. At that particular time, there were some debates as to the best way to go about introducing computer literacy, but that was not actually one of the focuses of my work.
So how did it go from like being designed to getting in every school, or it seemed like every school, my tiny little school in rural Northern California?
Well, there's like 65 million copies sold, wasn't there?
Or distributed, yes. So part of the lucky for me aspect of this was that MEC, which was the publisher of the product, had site licensing agreements with schools and school districts all across North America and beyond. And these site licenses allowed the schools to make unlimited copies for use within the schools.
Oh.
As a result, these site licenses were very popular because they got all of MEC's products and they were able to make lots of copies. And eventually, Oregon Trail became the most ubiquitous product in North American schools.
The biggest export from the state of Minnesota, would you say?
Yes, indeed.
So, you know, the game was for sure my first introduction to a computer. And I remember having to go as a class to this weird little room that they shoved a bunch of computers in for a couple hours a day or you know, a week. But the biggest thing, honestly, I remember was how hilarious we thought it was when our classmate got dysentery or something. So I read somewhere about that this like opportunity for childhood fascination with all the inelegant ways that pioneers died was not an accident. You intentionally wanted to shift the narrative about the dangers on the trail away from indigenous populations and kind of stereotypical violence and onto the more common and less Hollywood-worthy hazards along the way. So can you speak a little bit to that?
Oh, absolutely. There was a popular misconception at the time, which may still exist to some degree, that the leading cause of death along the Oregon Trail was attacks by Native Americans. And this was just completely false. Most of the deaths were caused by disease and accidents. And in fact, the relationships with Native Americans along the way were generally more of a trading nature. So I wanted to get this aspect in and completely refocus of what was Oregon Trail really about for the participants. I wanted young people to be able to experience it in a way that reflected reality more than the popular ideas of the time.
And Charlie, what are some of the ways that this game really reflects history of the time, like as it was considered in the 80s? And versus where we are now in the way we think about this. I mean, there literally was a movement that came out after this game called the New Western History Movement, which emerged in the late 80s and really highlighted the antiquated ways the frontier was told and considered and demanded the recognition of diversity of peoples and experiences in Western contexts. So where do you see this game fitting in that narrative arc, Charlie?
Well, I think, like, you know, even for the time, it was a remarkably progressive game. And I think in many ways it still is today. You know, I had an experience last year with a little boy. We were talking about the Oregon Trail, and he told me that his teacher told him that the reason they'd have to circle up the wagons at night was because Indian attacks were so common. And this was, you know, only last year. So I think these narratives haven't gone away. And I think it's good that the game confronts those and doesn't really perpetuate them.
And I was thinking about some of that because, you know, there are definitely some Manifest Destiny vibes in the game, you know, which was a framework largely unchallenged until the late 20th century, you know, this colonial perspective. And I read one critique that said it framed Western migration as an adventure for fun rather than reflecting it as the invasion of sovereign native lands. And it was. But I wonder if so many, like this generation, the Oregon Trail generation being introduced to this concept, and some of the ways that this game tweaked the traditional telling of those stories kind of maybe made everybody a little bit more ready for a conversation about really what settler colonialism means and what it meant to these places and spaces. Charlie, what do you think about that?
You know, a lot of the information in the game is kind of contained within these, they're called like Talk to Me. So you go in each of these landmarks, and they're all real landmarks along the Oregon Trail, and you find these, each one has three different pre-programmed pieces of dialogue. And that gives you, you know, different pieces of information, like it gives you tips about how to succeed on the trail, but it also includes some bits of information. Like, for instance, at the Walla Walla Fort, there is a bit about the Whitman murders. And there's a Cayuse man who basically says, you know, you asked me about the Whitmans, and I'm telling you that Marcus Whitman was in the wrong for treating us, that he shouldn't have treated us because by the laws of the Cayuse, people who were failed medicine men who treated somebody who died, they had to be killed. And Marcus Whitman, who was a frontier missionary and doctor, he treated them anyway, and he was killed for it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that at the time, people were still perpetuating extremely, extremely outdated narratives about Marcus Whitman. But at the same time, I read a pretty interesting critique about the sequel game to the Oregon Trail, which is sort of similar but much, much more complex. And it really framed it in a really interesting way where it kind of talks about how the game is very much from a male perspective. You know, you're focused on like the survival, but not so much on like the domestic realities. Like women on the trail, they were responsible for keeping the family together and, you know, doing all the daily tasks of life, such as cooking, managing children. The critique thought that that aspect was missing from the game.
You're listening to Underground History on the Jefferson Exchange. You can find us online at jeffexchange.org. I'm your host, Chelsea Rose, and today we are talking about the iconic Oregon Trail game. Charlie, talking about that makes me think about a movie that came out, I don't know, several years ago called The Meek's Cutoff, which followed the ill-fated wagon train attempting to make an infamous shortcut. The movie was interesting in that it really leaned into the tedium of the journey, so there's not a lot of quippy dialogue and brave action. It's long scenes of women doing laundry in the river and kind of standing by while men made decisions for them, and they didn't really have a voice in some of the considerations that were happening. And, you know, kind of as a result, it was boring, but in a good way and probably more reflective of like the actual experience. But this is kind of a question for both of you. So how do you juggle? I mean, I have no idea how successful that movie was. I thought it was interesting. But how do you juggle making a good and catchy story without compromising authenticity or leaning into some of the stereotypes that people really are expecting? Like, Philip, was there pushback when people came in thinking they were getting one version of the Oregon Trail and it's a little bit more nuanced and maybe not what the late 70s, early 80s version would have been expected?
There was a little bit of pushback. Part of the pushback was simply from educators who wanted a more didactic presentation. And then there was some pushback from people who didn't like that I eliminated medicine from the game because I didn't find evidence that the medicines were particularly effective. I had a personal goal, which I wasn't able to fully attain, which was that I wanted to really communicate more about Native Americans than I was able to incorporate into this particular framework, because the framework really is about a heroic survival, trying to make it from all the way from Independence, Missouri, all the way to Oregon. And so I had all these ideas I could not incorporate. 5 years later, I produced another Apple II product called Lewis and Clark Stayed Home. And that framework was so much more appropriate for all these ideas because Lewis and Clark were tasked with meeting Native Americans, as many as they could, and befriending them and getting to know about them and doing that research. And so it's like, wow, I can do a game where your entire goal is going out and meeting and befriending all these people and realizing the huge diversity of Native American culture across North America. So yes, the framework of the game itself had an important impact on what the details were for the player.
And indigenous storylines and perspectives were added to later versions of the Oregon Trail game, right? Later iterations?
That's correct, although I'm not familiar with all of those versions.
So there's, I haven't been able to play it because it's only on Apple, but the most current version that's for the Apple, I think, arcade, it's like an app, you can actually play as Native American characters. It's the very first edition to have Native American playable characters, and they actually have a storyline about Meek, about Meek's story. It's called Lost Hollow. Apparently it's very tricky, but, you know, what you were saying about the boringness of the movie, that is incredibly, incredibly accurate. Countless trail diaries, it always starts the same. They always get super excited and independence. You know, they're starting off on this great journey. And then after a couple weeks, you know, every day is kind of the same. And, you know, you're not at home, you're far away, and you're having to walk 15, 20 miles a day. And it starts to really wear off. And, you know, it really becomes a slog over the 6 months. And I know with the game, being that it was intended for the home market, but also for schools, you know, it can't really be a long slog because you only have so much time in the computer lab at school.
Yeah. And, you know, getting back to like some of the options, I was reading somewhere, Philip, that you wanted to provide an option whether to go down the Columbia or take the Barlow route, which was really a critical and heartbreaking decision point for travelers. You know, neither was particularly safe. But there wasn't enough disk space at the time is what I was reading. But can you tell us a little bit more about how you navigated the creative process and the technological constraints of the time? Because this really is new. I mean, nowadays people make games all the time, but had anybody done anything like this before?
Well, there certainly were a lot of new aspects of this. And I did get the Barlow Road in there, but not in the form I had originally wanted to. I had to go with a much simpler approach on the Barlow Road. Right from the beginning, I produced all these ideas, a long list of ideas that I knew couldn't all get in there. And so we had to gradually throw out ideas and figure out what's the highest priority, what is most essential. And the problems involved extremely limited space in Apple RAM, extremely limited space on the floppy disk. There was no hard drive, just floppy disk. Very low resolution of the screen, only six colors, plus not even a very big budget. It was big for 1984 and 85, but it was not big by later measures. So it was constantly a trade-off between what we would have loved to have done and what was actually possible.
And, you know, also, I want to maybe expand on a little bit about what the world was that this was going into. Like, there was no internet. There wasn't Game Boys. Very few people had home computers. You know, for the youngins like Charlie, like, it's probably hard for them to even to just stop and think about how disconnected we were from, you know, what we take for granted today. So can you talk a little bit about what it was like for people to access computers for the first time? And did you or did anybody have any sort of inkling of what would be, you know, I could play the game on my phone right now if I wanted to? You know, like, that's such a crazy, I guess because I'm part of the Oregon Trail generation, I rode that journey and it's crazy to see how far we've come. So can you speak a little bit about that?
Sure. So my background was in the 70s working with timeshare computers. And even when the 6502 chip and the 8080 chip and the other chips started coming out, I was not predicting the future. I had no idea that this would lead to personal computers and game devices and arcade machines. But by the early 80s, all this was suddenly appearing. It was dramatically changing the world. My whole experience with computers on timeshare systems was now disappearing. So, yes, it was a rapidly changing world, and even to the point that the products that were created in 1980, which were all done by amateurs, were no longer really sellable in 1984, because by that point, professionals had been jumping in, and various companies were now creating products rather than all being done by volunteers in their spare time, which was actually one of the motivations for doing this new version of the Oregon Trail. We wanted a professional-looking version and keeping with the times.
Yeah.
So it was a rapidly changing world. And even, of course, in 1984 and 85, when I was doing this, I was not able to predict the future at all. I had no idea what was coming, but I wanted to do the best I could for that particular moment in time.
So we're going to take a quick break so we can restock the wagons and cross a river, but we'll be back with more underground history. And we're back. I'm your host, Chelsea Rose, and so far none of my party has gotten dysentery, so we can continue talking about the long journey over the Oregon Trail that brought a generation of kids into the digital world. Charlie, how did you get introduced into this game? And I know it's attained like cult classics, but when you first played it, like, what were your thoughts as somebody who was born digital, like you were born in this digital world?
Well, for me, I was kind of coming at it like I'm a huge, huge Oregon Trail nerd. I've always been a huge Oregon Trail nerd. Like, one of my favorite books when I was a kid was a book about Catherine Sager, who's actually mentioned in the game. She's one of the seven children who was orphaned along the Oregon Trail in 1844 and adopted by the Whitmans. And I actually don't remember how old I was when I first played the game. You know, we didn't play it in school that I can remember. We did more of an immersive simulation on like paper and pencil. But playing the game now, I guess it's kind of hard for me to kind of see it like disconnected from my knowledge, because like when I play it, I'm usually looking at it like with a research lens, like, oh, how did they interpret the Oregon Trail instead of so much, how did they make this into a playable video game?
And, you know, I was wondering about something you said earlier, Charlie, about how some of the ways that the game would talk to you would be excerpts from, like, trail diaries. So, Philip, how did you guys track those down? Again, before the internet, they're not digital, so you would have to, like, go to archives or, like, you know, coordinate with researchers that had access to these kind of documents to get these stories?
Well, one of my principal colleagues on this project was named Shirley Caron. And she had a great interest in the diaries at the time. So we divided the research between us. I researched the historical accounts, that is, accounts written by historians, and she researched the diaries. So she did a lot of research on that. And every time we got together for brainstorming or talking, that would influence her take on how the product should develop. And I listened, of course, to all my colleagues, including Shirley. Then when it came time to start writing these dialogues, these monologues, 48 of them in the product, I sketched out some of the key concepts I wanted to communicate and at which landmarks. And then I gave Shirley first crack at writing many of them. So she drew a lot of her inspiration from these diaries, but I don't know specifically which diaries she used.
Charlie might, because Charlie's probably read a lot of them too.
Yeah, there was... I think you mentioned Celinda Hines. She's mentioned in the game frequently. Catherine Sager, most likely she used her diary. And then I've heard from a friend of mine that the diary was used of a local boy, Wellborn Beeson, whose father was...
Local to us, you mean?
Local to
Southern Oregon.
Yes, local to Southern Oregon. And his father was pretty incredible. He was actually criticized for being too friendly to the Native Americans at the time, and he was actually... ended up leaving Oregon for a while because of it, because he was actually going to be attacked because of his, like, love for the Native Americans.
Mm-hmm. So I wonder how would this, you know, this game, when it came out, there wasn't a lot of competition. So it was like a new novel thing. But if you were to design this game now, maybe the two of you could even team up on it. Like, what kind of things do you think would be opportunities that we have access to now? Because, you know, if nothing else, you know, the technology is different. But also, there is infinitely more primary documents that are accessible because of, you know, them being digital.
Well, if I was going to design...
And if you guys end up designing this game, I want to cut, okay?
I know a lot of the current versions have actually had kind of the opposite problem. They have not been really developed as an educational tool. So, for instance, the game that I played when I was a kid, my version of the Oregon Trail was on the Nintendo Wii. That was kind of... our console, that was really revolutionary technology as well at the time, like motion controls. But the problem with the actual game is it kind of didn't work out the mechanics. Like, for instance, with river crossings, you kind of just drive across them. So you get to, like, the Snake River, you just drive across, you don't capsize at all. That's not very realistic. But, you know, if I was going to make a game, I would really incorporate primary source analysis and immersion, representing all kinds of different viewpoints, you know, not just the pioneers, but Native Americans, people of different ethnicities who traveled the Oregon Trail. You know, there might not have been a lot, but there were certainly a sizable number.
And Philip, how about you? You didn't get to do all your great ideas, but now, you know, all things being equal, with my fictional blank check, what would you do differently?
Oh, there are so many things that I would do differently. In fact, even if I had an opportunity to have changed it just a few years after it first came out, I had a number of details that I felt these are a top priority. I want to fix them. Some of them had to do with gameplay, but a lot of them had to do with historical aspects. But now, if I were to get a chance to do it again, I would really rethink things from ground up, just like I did 40 years ago, that rather than knowing right up front exactly what I would want to do, I really want to think it through. I think Charlie had a lot of great points. And I think there's even more points to discover in terms of what ought to be in a new version.
Yeah, you're listening to Underground History on the Jefferson Exchange. I'm your host, Chelsea Rose, speaking with Philip Bouchard and Charlie Zimmerman about the Oregon Trail game. You know, one of the things I wanted to talk about a little bit of like the aesthetic of it, like the visuals are so iconic in the game. And you mentioned earlier you only had six colors you could use. And I think that, you know, compared to modern video game, it's primitive, but it really holds up as like a vibe. And maybe that's just my nostalgia since I, you know, played this as a kid. But I wanted to talk a little bit about how, you know, did you have artists, graphic artists, or how did the visuals come to be?
Yes, we had one graphic designer on the team. Her name is Sherilyn Kaplinger, and she was great. I always enjoyed working with her. And of course, she worked then with the team in terms of the details, like a hunting game, for example. And but the main screen that people think about is the travel screen. Mm-hmm. And that is a fascinating case because my first cut on the travel screen in terms of the design for it, then which Sherilyn followed, didn't work when we did the alpha test. It didn't hold the attention of the kids we were testing with. So it was very clear that we needed to completely rethink how that travel screen worked. And then one of my colleagues who wasn't even on the team suggested, well, how about a little animation of an ox pulling a cart across? So we took that idea, we experimented with it, and went through a long evolution of ideas until we ended up with the travel screen that eventually became the de facto branding of the product. And it was very successful and traceable to this offhand comment by somebody who wasn't even on the team.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's amazing. You know, one of the things, I think this is in the game, like the decisions about you brought, you know, a chest or like a big furniture and you have to, at some point it's too heavy and you have to leave that stuff behind. Like that's such a real part of the Oregon Trail experience and sometimes a very heartbreaking part, people having to leave behind these things that they're trying to bring from home that have sentimental value. And as the archaeologist in me, I always think that's really interesting because that's really the material culture of the trail. But Charlie, you have a little archaeology experience and history experience. So I'm wondering if you see ways in which some of the material culture could be worked into the game or is already in the existing versions of the game.
Yeah, so the game has like a very simplified version of that, probably because, you know, it had to be playable in 45 minutes and there's only so much disk space. So they don't really have like that level of detail with the items. But that is something like when I do my educational activities, pack your wagon activities are one of the top things we like to do because it does get kids making those choices about what to pack. But as far as actual gameplay, you know, as you went along, there would be just trash everywhere, pretty much. And there is in the game, there is a mechanic where you can sometimes find a wagon and it will have items in it. Because some people, if they had a fatal defect in their wagon, like if the wheels fell off or if too many of their oxen died, they would have to leave their entire wagons behind. And I think like along the trail, you know, there's a grave about 10 to 15 graves per mile of the trail. And I think there's a lot of opportunities for research, but as far as gameplay, you know, I think it'd be cool to see an archaeology activity where you can, like, find some of these things people left and learn more about them that way.
I remember reading somewhere that the wagon brakes, were really heavy and people had to go along a whole lot of flat land. And they're like, why are we carrying this stupid heavy piece of metal? And they got rid of it. And then you get into Eastern Oregon and you're about to go over the mountains and you're like, uh-oh. So people had to tie like trees and stuff behind the wagons to slow them down. So, yeah. You know, some of that is like a fun, you wouldn't think about it until, you know, you had that experience.
I actually have researched a lot into wagon brakes specifically, and a lot of wagons actually didn't have them at all. They were like an add-on. So they would use tree branches, or they would simply tie the wheels together, and that would kind of act as a brake because it kept the wheels from moving. They would use like called wheel shoes under the wheels to keep them from rotating. But definitely tying to a tree. Like there's one particular, it didn't make it into the game. There's one particular landmark called Windlass Hill that's in the Great Plains area that would, it was called that because wagons would have to be tied to a tree and kind of very slowly lowered down with a windlass.
Wow. These are such great points, and these would have been more overtly addressed had I been able to work in the Barlow Road game that I had intended, where you would have to pull out ropes, pulleys, levers, and so on to get up and down the hills of the Barlow Road. And also probably more explicitly acknowledge having to abandon things along the way.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that that's such, you know, I think that the thing that was really impactful for all the kids that played this game was putting themselves in this decision point. And probably for a lot of us, I don't know, 10 or whatever we were first introduced to it, like, having to make decisions that had consequences is like an interesting exercise just as a kid to do. But then, you know, thinking also about the real life experiences on these trails and what do you bring? What do you, you know, stuff that you need to survive or stuff that you want to have when you get to Oregon?
Yeah, that was a really tricky decision, like what to pack, because typically your wagon would only be able to pull around 2,000, maybe 2,400 pounds. And, you know, people did have to make a lot of those hard decisions. And often a lot of those hard decisions would have to be made along the way when you started losing oxen or when they started getting really tired or when the path started getting really hilly. In particular, cast iron stoves are something that was one of the most common abandoned items because they're super heavy and you don't really need one. They're very nice to have, but you can always cook over a fire. Yeah. And that's something when we do a pack your wagon activity over at the Southern Oregon Historical Society, we actually have these little quarter size wagons and we have like a bunch of items that kids can pack with. And, you know, I do the activity with kids and every time I tell them, all right, the cast iron stove is not the thing we need the most. And every time kids picks it up and puts it right in the wagon.
One final question to leave us on is, you know, the Oregon Trail ends in Oregon. And Charlie and I are both from the West Coast, but, you know, thousands and thousands of kids played this that aren't from the West Coast. So I wonder, Philip, if you have any thoughts on how this game was experienced for different people across the U.S. We're all having this kind of shared experience at the time learning about this piece of history, but, you know, people are thinking about it in different ways because they're, you know, where they're regionally situated in their own kind of local portion of this tale.
Yes, I think people mostly associate the Oregon Trail with the more easterly parts of the trail. They picture the plains in particular, and maybe just getting into the mountains. I think there's a less thorough image of the west, more westerly parts of the route. And I also think that there's not enough popular knowledge about the dense Native American populations that were on the Pacific Northwest prior to the Oregon Trail. That's an aspect that I would certainly like to help people understand better.
Yeah, there was a lot of people here watching the east as people came west. So I think that's an interesting point for sure. So that wraps up this edition of Underground History. I'm your host, Chelsea Rose. My show producer is Charlie Zimmerman, who is also a rut nut, which is what they call or trail enthusiasts. Thank you so much, Charlie and Philip, for joining me today. You can find this episode and many more wherever you get your podcasts.